This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Take a vacation from your bills, pay off credit cards, and save thousands of dollars after a simple phone call to Golden Oak Lending. Visit GoldenOakLending.com to speak to someone today.
Golden Oak Lending, cured my blues.
NMLS 114937.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you have a locked AT&T phone, we're here with Bolt Cutters. T-Mobile will help pay off your locked phone and give you a new 5G phone for free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom.
Via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax and a $10 device connection charge. Qualifying port and trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement as due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early.
It is dark 12 right now, 6:12, and the Crescent City Connection twinkling beautifully with, I don't know what color it was at first till I got up on it, then I realized that it was the Pelicans colors. And the reason is it's still plenty dark because of daylight saving time. But it's going to be a beautiful day today, highs of 70, which then that's going to be around, say, 6, 7 o'clock or so. So it'll be really nice and beautiful outside. 72 tomorrow, plenty of sunshine. 75 on Wednesday, plenty of sunshine. Thursday, sunny, warm, highs of 81. Some clouds moving in Friday, highs of 80. And then Saturday could be stormy, which is not good because they got some parades scheduled. But we'll see how that plays out. And then Sunday is supposed to be nice with highs of 79. I think Argus and the St. Patrick's Day Parade, Tim Zimmer, are on Sunday, correct? In Metairie? Yeah. So the weather should be nice for that. Let's hope it all times out. I don't know what's going to happen in Washington with the timing of this bill, this 99-page bill to avert a government shutdown, but maybe Dr. Robert Hogan can join us, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. How you doing, doctor?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. This is a 99-page bill. One of the things that I guess became popular years ago, maybe Obamacare, when people started really pushing this, was did anybody actually read the bill? I don't know. Did anybody read this 99-page bill so far? Do they in Congress, or do they have staffers? Each person reads a portion of it and gives them an executive summary.
Well, I think they do read the bill these days, and 99 pages isn't too long. This is a continuing resolution, and so what it does is not all that complicated in many respects. What it means is that they want to continue the budget through September 30th of this year at the current levels that it was last year. And this is the way a lot of people, you know, complain about this, but this is the way that budgets are. I mean, this is a common way now of passing budgets in Congress. That is not to go through the slow and deliberative process for the 12 different committees of coming up with a budget and then having it approved overall. But they basically just say, you know what, we'll just keep funding levels at last year's level and sort of kick the can down the road approach. A lot of people are asking themselves, you know, why are Republicans doing this? I mean, the Republicans won control. They've got control of both houses of Congress and the presidency. Why don't they just come up with a brand new budget that emphasizes their priorities? Because using last year's budget, there are things that emphasize, you know, Biden's priorities. And the simple answer to that question is there's a razor thin margin in the House of Representatives that the Republicans have a majority in there, and they don't have a big majority in the Senate where they need at least 60 votes to control the chamber. So they're hoping that the Democrats, or at least a small number of Democrats, will go along with them on this. And that's ultimately, I think, what they're going to need to get it passed. I mean, that is what they will need to get it passed.
Let me jump in 1 second, Professor, if I can, because, okay, the Republicans got the House, got the Senate, got the White House, the House of Representatives in the White House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So President Trump wanted a big, beautiful, clean bill. He talked about a mandate after having won the election. So you would think the Republicans would be in the driver's seat to produce this one big, beautiful, clean bill. Is it? And I'm using a quotation mark. This is the president.
Sure.
But is that a function of time? Could they not have passed, if you're a hardliner and you want President Trump's one big, beautiful bill, could they have not passed a one-month continuing resolution and then got to work on this?
Well, I think they want to give themselves time, because what they ultimately want to do is to pass a new budget and that includes continuation of large tax cuts that Trump wants. It's a big priority for him. These are, in order for those tax cuts to continue, they have to be voted upon again, and also other cuts and changes to the budget. So they're trying to give themselves a lot of room, because they know they're going to need it to be able to get these things through, because, again, the margins in both houses are quite small. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons. The other reason is I think that the Republicans are viewing what's going on right now with Elon Musk and the Doge and all of that cutting of the bureaucracy. This is a new approach to budget cutting in Washington that we've not seen before, in which the president, lays siege to many of the big bureaucracies in Washington, cutting it from the other end, so to speak. Normally, the president tries to sell his package, sell his ideas to the American public, to put pressure on members of Congress to support it. What this president is doing is focusing on the bureaucracy. They're claiming everything that they don't like as waste, fraud, and abuse. And they're hoping that they're going to be able to use that as leverage in budget negotiations in the coming months. So that's a new part, a brand new approach that we're seeing that this president is using that the previous presidents have not. So that's part of what's going on as well. They want to make time for more of this exposure of these problems that they're pointing to in the bureaucracy. They think that's going to give them leverage in further budget cuts later in the year.
But politically, President Trump puts the bully in bully pulpit, right? I mean, let's be honest, he does. And before the midterms, I would think the power that he has is as consolidated as it possibly can be.
So absolutely right.
Does he have, if every Republican would just close ranks and vote along on this big, beautiful bill, could it get done? Are the votes there? Could it happen?
Well, no. I mean, I think if every Republican in the House of Representatives voted for it, yes, it could pass there. In the Senate, it can't. They only have 53 votes there. They need 60 because this is not part of the reconciliation process.
Oh, okay.
The continuing resolution still requires getting over that 60 vote threshold in the Senate. So even if the House passes it, they're going to have to negotiate to some extent with the Democrats. You're going to have to get some Democrats to support it. And if you recall, I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult for them to even get out of the House with this. Johnson has been unable to pass anything major since he has been Speaker, without the support of Democrats. Democrats at the end would come swoop in and in mass, all of them unanimously support what it was that the Democrats decided to vote with Johnson. Johnson was unable to muster support from his own caucus, because there are those members of the Freedom Caucus who really do not like things like continuing resolutions. Now, a lot of them have softened on that position, in part because they view the Elon Musk attempt to going after the budget. They like that, and they want to see that continue. And a way to see that continue is to avert a budget crisis. Because let me put it this way: if they don't come up with a plan by the end of this week, the government shuts down, and there are certain government functions that will cease. And what that means is, well, the question is, who gets blamed for that? Do the Republicans get blamed for it? And I think a lot of people saying, hey, you all control the government. Why can't you make it work? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people will blame the Republicans. And I think Democrats are counting on that in a way that they weren't during the last Congress.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Dr. Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU, trying to avert a government shutdown that would happen Saturday if they don't pass this continuing resolution. President Trump on social media saying all Republicans should vote please yes next week. Great things are coming for America, and I am asking you all to give us a few months to get us through to September so we can continue to put the country's financial house in order. That in quotes. That's what the president tweeted. Does that, we'll find out when we come back from Dr. Hogan, does that give Speaker Johnson help when it comes to the Freedom Caucus, which is what did previous speakers in when they courted Democratic votes? 622 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about the continuing. Is it one bill, Professor? Is it a one for each month? How does this work technically?
I'm almost certain this is just a vote for a continuing resolution that will keep funding at the previous levels through the end of the fiscal year, which ends on September 30th for the federal budget.
And I should say the professor is Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. So I asked you before the break, when it comes to political cover for Speaker Johnson courting Democratic votes and the president saying, please vote for this, I would imagine then, after the president's tweet, the Freedom Caucus would say, okay, well, President Trump wants this, let's vote for it, and that would keep him out of trouble and also keep him out of trouble with them for courting Democratic votes. Accurate or not?
No, I think that's that may be what ultimately happens. I mean, but he's still going to need Thomas Massie from Kentucky has already said he's going to vote against it. So he needs all the other Republicans to vote for it in order for it to pass. And that gives a tremendous amount of power to any one of those Republicans to step up and say, you know what, I'll vote for the bill, but could you add this or could you take this out? And so there's going to be a lot of intense behind the scenes negotiation over the next few days to see if this works. But again, you know, they're going to have to negotiate with the Democrats in the Senate. I mean, in the House, they haven't been negotiating with the Democrats. They cut off those negotiations. But in the Senate, they're going to have to in order to get seven of the Democrats to vote with the Republicans for it to ultimately pass. And it's going to have to be the same bill that the House Republicans passed. I mean, the House of Representatives passed. It's got to be the exact same bill. So these are very high hurdles that need to be passed in a very short period of time. And Democrats are not likely to swoop in at the last minute and provide support, because I think there is now the perception the person who will get the blame for this will be the Republicans and Donald Trump, whereas before, Democrats were worried that the Biden administration would get blamed for a government shutdown. So a government shutdown is not something that the Democrats fear in the way that they used to.
Let me get to this before we have 90 seconds left here. And I guess it goes to, like you're talking about, the guy from Tennessee, Massie, has a lot of power. It's like, you need my vote, so this is what I need. But when it comes to President Trump, and with the midterms coming up, with his, as he says, mandate that he won when he was elected, then I would think he would never be more powerful than he is right now. Is that an accurate statement or not?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And I mean, most of the time, most presidents, when they're first elected, they come out swinging with a legislative package that they're trying to get the American government, I mean, the American public to accept and get the Congress ultimately to adopt. And they go out and they run around the country and they try to sell it. This president has been doing that. He's been doing it sort of through the back way by attacking the bureaucracy first. And I think that they believe that will give them leverage later on. Whether that strategy works or not, we'll have to see.
I guess what I'm trying to say, Professor, is this seems like Massie or whoever else is opposing the president, they're staring at him eye to eye and they're saying who blinks first. Is that an overstatement or not?
No, I don't think so. I think that's an accurate way to look at it. And I'm not certain if you're right. I mean, Trump is he can move people's opinion in a way that other presidents have not been able to. So we'll have this will be a test of his power, certainly.
That's what surprises me, because considering President Trump's history and how hard it was for Republicans to stand up to him before, he is at his most powerful now. So it's going to be interesting to watch this play out politically. Thank you, Professor.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Nice talking to you.
Robert Hogan, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU. We'll take a break, come back, talk about DOGE. Right now, it's time for traffic on news, all that stuff on WWL. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. When it comes to big money items and budgets and government and policies, I always use the analogy, some of this stuff gets in the weeds, but if you've ever played golf for money, you know that's where most of the cheating goes on, right? Where it's thick and wiry and you can't see what's happening. Romina Baccia joins us now, Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Good morning, Romina. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about what's going on with the budget and the continuing resolutions. And I see an accounting gimmick here. I don't understand what all that is, to pretend extending the 2017 tax cuts, that saying that it won't increase the deficit, talking about our current policy baseline. This seems very confusing. But again, that's where a lot of the shenanigans happen, right?
Yes, the big debate right now is, of course, extending the Trump tax cuts and how to do so without adding significantly to the already excessive deficits that we have. You know, at $2 trillion annually and about 6% of GDP, our deficits are at levels that we normally only see during economic or public health crises like the COVID pandemic. But now that we've come out of the pandemic, why is the government still spending as if we are in a crisis? And so if we just extend the tax cuts and we don't cut spending to help pay for those tax cuts, then that deficit is going to grow further out of control. And so it is very unsustainable now at this stage to just extend the tax cuts. And so where this gimmick comes in is the House is saying we need to pay for the tax cuts. Here's some spending cuts to do so. They actually fall far short, but at least they're trying. And now the Senate is saying, we're not so sure about spending cuts at all because those are really politically tricky. Why don't we just extend the tax cuts and just pretend like they don't add to the deficit?
Somebody texted in. I was asking people to text in their thoughts because I was talking about Romina before you came on, about process as opposed to results. And sometimes I think people confuse process with results and they don't like the process. And maybe sometimes there are results they like, sometimes results they don't like. Sometimes there are no results, just the process itself. And somebody texted in and said, ending government waste spending and making the rest of the world spend their money that they're supposed to be spending, I'm satisfied so far. Well, that sounds good, but is that what happened? Or what's happening?
Well, you know, it's sort of people are looking at some of President Trump's campaign promises on the margin, and they're a shift in the direction of policy priorities. And that is happening. However, those are very small savings in comparison to the size of the overall federal budget. Where the real meat is in order to reduce spending and reduce deficits is in healthcare programs and retirement programs, which together make up more than 50% of the budget. Then you have, you know, interest on the debt, which you can't really cut. That makes up another large portion. In fact, last year, interest on the debt was about $1 trillion. It is now as high as our entire defense budget, which is deeply troubling. And then you can cut some other things. And so where DOGE and the president have been primarily active is in those other things. But as part of these tax cut extensions, we're actually talking about making some long overdue changes to the Medicaid program, which has grown significantly in part due to the Obamacare expansion from 2014. And since then, the share that the federal government pays of what is supposed to be a state-administered program has gone up significantly, where the federal government now covers like three-quarters, up to 75 cents of every dollar that states spend, which also makes it less likely for states to cap down on fraud, waste, abuse, and making sure that only people who are supposed to be eligible are continuing to receive benefits from this program, because if they only get to keep 25 cents of every dollar they save, they don't have as much of an incentive to make sure the program is run as efficiently as if they were on the hook for at least half of what Medicaid spends.
You're talking about the states now, right?
Yes, I'm talking about the state, because here's the problem, right? It's Washington is sending so much money to the states for programs that ultimately the states administer. This is the case for Medicaid. So you have that lack of accountability because the money's coming from Washington, but the states are actually in charge of how the programs are run. And so if they don't pay for the programs, why do they care who's actually on them?
So $2 trillion a year in deficit, the debt is up to $36.5 trillion and increasing. The focus is on DOGE. I see on this usdebtclock.org they have a DOGE clock, and it's going up savings per taxpayer. Anyway, the total is $184 trillion. I guess it is. I don't know where they got that number from. How do you know what's – can you put a number
on
what
– number – You can't believe that number, because that number is just made up. Elon Musk said he wants to cut $4 billion a day, and so literally the debt clock goes up by $4 billion every day, whether on the DOGE, you know, the DOGE aspect of the debt clock, whether they actually cut any spending or not. So that's made up, unfortunately, I have to tell you.
Just to be clear, it's $184 billion that's on there, not trillion. I misspoke. But let me take a break.
Yes.
Mina, when we come back, I want to talk about Medicaid, because Louisiana is a solid red state.
We don't have
the money to pay for Medicaid. I don't think we do right now. I think it would bankrupt the state. But then that goes to who should get Medicaid, who doesn't. When it comes to DOGE, who's getting benefits that shouldn't? How much fraud, waste, and abuse is there? I don't think anybody wants to say, from the humane standpoint, that people shouldn't get treatment if they can't afford it. But on the other hand, if you don't give them treatment, from the practical standpoint, they're going to go to the emergency room, and guess who pays for that? Us. So I don't know what you do, unless you want to go all Dickens and decrease the surplus population and let people die. I don't know what the answer is. 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, Tommy Tucker, WWL, trying to get the truth behind the budget and where the money's being spent and what's being saved and what isn't. Romina Batya joins us as our guest, rather, Director of Budget and Entitlement Policy with the Cato Institute. So when it comes to, Romina, I know Medicaid is the third largest expense in the federal defense. I'll get it out. Why don't you tell me where Medicaid stands in a budget? Might be easier for you to get it out.
Yeah, it has become increasingly expensive. The most expensive program is Social Security, followed by Medicare and Medicaid. Now, interest on the debt is actually larger than Medicare or Medicaid, but it's not really a federal government program. It's what we have to pay for the debt that we've already incurred. So it is a budget category, but I wouldn't call it a program. By the way, I did look into the Medicaid enrollment figures in Louisiana, and they're surprisingly very similar to the broader U.S. rates. Mm-hmm. In Louisiana, it says the uninsured rate is 19%. For the entire United States, it's 17%. And Louisiana is also one of the states that participated in the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, which increased Medicaid eligibility for people who are neither children, pregnant women, or individuals with disabilities or seniors. And so this is one of the problems, actually, that we have with Medicaid that we should tackle. The improper payment rates since the Medicaid expansion have gone through the roof, with my colleagues Rachel Gressler and Brian Blaze at the Paragon Health Institute calculating that we've had over $1 trillion in improper payments in the Medicaid program
Before we run out of time, improper payments to whom? Who's making money off of this?
The health providers and the states that are claiming people are eligible for Medicaid that shouldn't be, because the states aren't doing proper eligibility checks.
That's fraud, waste, and abuse at a big old high level, right? Has anybody looked at that?
We should all be able to get behind cutting that.
Has Elon Musk looked at that?
I don't believe Elon Musk has looked at that, but I know Congress is actively looking at that right now, and it's particular senators that are crossing their arms and saying, yeah, maybe there is all this fraud, waste, and abuse, but we're still worried about our reelection prospects, so don't touch it.
There you go. Thank you. I appreciate your time, Romina Baccia, just trying to get the truth from the politics and the news headlines and all of this stuff. We'll be back. Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, Dark 14 right now, 7:14 as we adjust to daylight saving time. Beautiful day today. Plenty of sunshine, highs near 70, and that's not until, you know, it starts to turn dark around 7 o'clock or so. Then highs of 72 tomorrow, 75 on Wednesday, 81 Thursday, 80 Friday. All dry, no rain. But then Saturday, maybe some severe weather. We'll have to watch that. Sunday for the parades, nice. You got Argus rolling in Metairie with the St. Patrick's Day Parade down Metairie Road. Plenty of sunshine.
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor superfan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Highs of 79, so wear the sunscreen for that. Kirk Talbot joins us now, Louisiana State Senator. How you doing, Kirk?
Great. Good morning.
Kirk, you are a businessman, are you not?
I am, yes.
Let's talk for a moment, if you will, and I know this is not why you came on, but, you know, there's this big thing about DOGE and where the real money is and all federal employees is, all employees. And there is because you employ people and you're in the private sector, but that's not to say all government employees are bad, right? I mean, tell me how you look at that from a business standpoint or from a businessman standpoint.
Certainly not. I mean, we have some great government workers. I think the part of this that I find interesting is that, you know, you cut 10% or 15% of a workforce from a department and, you know, they're screaming bloody murder. And in the private sector, you know, we ebb and flow. I mean, mm-hmm. during Katrina, during different times in our careers as a businessman, we might have to cut our workforce 20-30% just to keep the lights on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you find a way to adjust. You find a way to, you cut the fat and you get down to the bone and you survive and you make it through the year. And then, you know, you staff up when things are good. But in the public sector, it's just different because, you know, you're not trying to make money. You're not trying to make a profit. It's just a whole different beast. And I think this government is bloated and needs a little dose of reality and needs a little dose of the private sector, so to speak, to kind of bring it back to earth.
Along those lines, and I'm just talking about the business model here, can you run a government like you can a business and have layoffs here and then bring people back? Or when it comes to, I guess, incentives and changing and all those kind of things, can you make a comparison or not? I'm not arguing with you. I'm just trying to understand the whole business standpoint.
I don't think you can just simply say that you can run government like a business. It's not that simple. But I do think that there's waste and fraud and abuse. Clearly there is in some of the things that we've seen, and the belt needs to be tightened a little bit. And, you know, I just hope that, you know, we don't cut something that we're going to end up regretting.
Yeah.
But it seems like some of the stories and some of the news articles I've read that there's some serious waste and abuse and fraud going on, and that needs to be rooted out, and they seem to be doing that.
My concern is that you don't poison the entire yard. You pull out the weeds and you keep the grass.
Sure.
That's my concern.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yes.
Hey, and let me move on to Medicaid, since we're talking about all of that, because we were just talking about Medicaid as a percentage of the federal budget, and if 10% of the federal budget, and if that were to be cut for Louisiana. I'm trying to determine, looking at the big picture here, Kirk, when it comes to Medicaid and people that don't have insurance, and here's the deal. Are there people on Medicaid right now that don't deserve it? Are people overcharging for Medicaid that provide services, and that's where the real theft is? What do you do with people that don't have insurance or can't take care of themselves, because if they wind up in the emergency room, you and I are going to wind up paying for that economically in the long run, right? Do you go all Dickens and let them die and let them decrease the surplus population, as terrible as that sounds? Take me through this, because I don't know how to solve a problem like that.
No, I mean, I think what President Trump has said is, if you deserve to have Medicaid and be on Medicaid, you're going to get it and you're going to keep it. But there are people that shouldn't be on it that are getting it, and they are hospitals or doctors, whatever you want to call it, that are charging more than and they shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that they need to root out, and those are the things that they're looking into. You know, if you deserve it and you qualify for it, you're going to get it. But if you don't, then you shouldn't. And people that are, you know, we see these stories all the time where, you know, a medical clinic or a doctor, or whatever, you know, gets popped for overcharging Medicaid. And I think that happens a lot more than we know, and is abused a lot more than we know. And that's the things that they're looking into, and they should look into that.
So when it comes to whose responsibility is it to determine what's waste and where the money's being stolen, what have you, and who's getting it that shouldn't, is that up to the state or is that up to the federal government?
I think both. I mean, it's clearly, you know, the state, we receive that money and it all filters through us. So we have skin in the game for sure. But, you know, the federal government has, you know, unlimited, it seems, the resources to really root that out. I mean, the buck stops with, or really starts with the federal government. It ends on our end. So I think it needs to be a collaboration between the federal government and the state government to make sure that people who deserve it and who need it should be on it, and people who aren't shouldn't be.
And
it shouldn't be overcharged.
And the reason I ask is, if the expansion that John Bel Edwards approved goes away, then how does the state deal with that? What would be the process, or is that something you guys are going to look at this session coming up or not?
I don't think that will go away. But if I recall, when the states were starting to expand Medicaid, you had states like Arkansas that were really, really tight on, you know, who's going to get this and you know, scrutinize that. And you know, we pushed John Bel to do that, and it seemed, or that administration to do that, and it seems like we didn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. If I recall, I think that's the tact we need to take, is let's make sure the people that qualify for it are getting in, the people that don't aren't. And that, you know, it's not being abused and being overcharged. So I think that's the tack. I haven't heard Governor Landry say anything about stopping that. Mm-hmm. I think they just need to scrutinize it more and make sure it's being done efficiently.
I was just wondering about the regulation, because if you're concerned with federal spending, then it would be responsible, I think, to clean your own house up, right, when it comes to Medicaid and see who should and who shouldn't. But at this time, you're saying there are no plans to do that?
That's just what I haven't seen that. So don't take that.
No, I understand. And look, we didn't invite you on to talk about that, but we were talking about it, so I'd pick your brain on it, because you are a businessman, and I thought you'd have some interesting insights. Let's take a break, talk about insurance when we come back with Kirk Talbot, Louisiana State Senator. 722, traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Senator Kirk Talbot. Let's talk about the session, Kirk, and insurance and what is on the schedule? What can be done to help? Insurance is a primary concern. Property, auto, both?
Well, certainly the last couple of years, we've taken a big swipe at property insurance. I mean, we've done a lot of legislation, addressed a lot of issues, things like, you know, multiple adjusters, making insurance companies more solvent, requiring them to have more money in their reserves so they can pay claims. We've revamped the entire claims process. We've revamped the appraisal process. We've started the Fortified Roof Program. You're going to see legislation this year. We're going to find a way, and Commissioner Temple has been working with us on this, to permanently fund the Fortified Roof Program. And I highly recommend your listeners to, you know, apply for that lottery system, because that is the way. That is the long-term solution for us living in South Louisiana, is to get a fortified roof and to get that on your house as soon as possible. So you're going to see, you know, we're always going to have legislation on property insurance, just because it's always a moving target. So, you know, you'll see some more on that. But auto insurance is where we really have a lot of work to do. after the session, the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate approached us, some of the chairmen that deal with insurance, to take another stab at auto insurance and kind of like start over and start having meetings, which we've had since session ended last year, in really kind of an unprecedented way. We've had five different committees that all touch auto insurance in some form or fashion, have had these meetings, and, you know, we've looked at everything, Tommy, and I know we don't have it. I could talk to this for an hour, but I'll just
say
come
back
real quick. I'll come back anytime.
All right.
But you know, what we've really found is there's no reason why we should have the highest insurance in the country. I get it on property insurance. We have a coastal state. The majority of our population is below I-10. We're, you know, unfortunately, the number one destination for named storms that hit land. But with auto insurance, we shouldn't be. There's nothing that causes us to be an outlier, you know, that we can't control. It's our legal system, and it's something that we can fix, just like we did with workers' comp in the 1980s. We had a horrible workers' comp environment where basically you know, workers' comp was unaffordable, and we fixed it. And we need to do the same thing with auto insurance. And, you know, there's a lot of talks going on, a lot of ideas floating out there. And, you know, it is a huge, important issue. And I think if we don't fix this auto insurance thing, it's going to hold our state back. We're never going to reach the goals that every governor that runs that I've seen, you know, wants to do, create jobs, create a strong middle class. You can't do that unless we fix this auto insurance problem.
You're being jammed up two ways. You got the homeowner's insurance, which, as you said, is a function of nature. But then you got the auto insurance, which maybe could save some people some money. Kirk, you have to come back. We'll spend an hour. We'll take
anytime.
Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, line them up, talk about why it's lower there, higher here, lower there, and what can be done to get us more in line with them. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Kirk Talbott, Louisiana State Senator, coming back, taking a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. It's Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. First, though, it's time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8. Time for Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Is WWL. I'm Tommy Tucker, and Mark Rosa, let's take a look down Wall Street and see what's going to happen this week.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. It's good. I'm enjoying that little bit of daylight saving time. I like it.
What are you going to do this afternoon with that extra hour?
Well, it at least it's light outside. You know, when it gets dark so early, you just feel like it's time to go to bed. You and I are early risers,
right.
So, you know, you just start kind of going in that direction. Mm-hmm. And if it's light outside, yesterday I was going in that direction, looked out, and it's light. Well, maybe I should be doing other things. So mm-hmm. great's a little ambition.
There you go.
Anyway.
Let's talk about Wall Street and ambition, and if you want to make some money, what do you do?
Well, last week, Tom, we promised to segue it over into this week. We have something that's happened, a couple of three things, actually. So mortgage rates fell for 6 weeks in a row. We were reporting that last week, and then it fell yet another week. So people are looking at that very, very focused. And the refinances have surged 83% year over year, where people stuck in higher mortgages as a way to get out. And with these rates falling, it apparently is shaking the tree, so to speak, and getting people out there and wanting to save some money. And we wanted to report this naturally, and because of the good that it could do some people to take advantage of lower rates. But where's it coming from? It's coming from the talks of the tariffs. This morning's news, I was just listening before that Trump came on and said, well, we can't say that a recession won't be the result of some of the work that they're doing. If it was, if that would come on into the economy, I would think it would be very short-lived. I think all this talk about tariff, my opinion only, is to shake up some of the other governments that enjoy large trade surpluses from us, and he's trying to even that playing field. Well, in the meantime, they're not going to be happy, and Canada comes out saying, no, we're not going to be bullied and everything. Yeah, they're going to be bullied. You're going to go toe-to-toe with the largest economy on earth, and we can stare them down on that, not to be kind of aggressive against our neighbors. But if they're enjoying these huge trade surpluses, there is some money that we could save on that. That's where the tariffs come in, and that's the tip of the spear and what the administration's trying to do. But in the meantime, Wall Street's saying, on one hand, two things that came out over the weekend. Economists think that a recession is going to be the result of the tariffs. And I would add to that my few words, only if it sticks around for a while. And this morning's news says chaos creates opportunities. Wall Street sees a dip as a buying chance. So they're thinking that this is going to be temporary. Whatever comes in, the Dow has taken a couple of hits, down about 1,400 over the past couple of weeks. It's right now about 42,400 and expect to open another between 300 and 400 down this morning. So Wall Street's saying buy it if it's coming down. And with the rates coming down, that goes hand in hand with the markets saying it's a little bit jittery, add some uncertainty for a lot of the lenders to make a loan to somebody where somebody's like, well, I don't know if the economy's going into a weak spat here. I'm going to hold on. You know, I'm not going to do anything. But refinancing your mortgage to get a lower rate, that would have, in my judgment, nobody has to worry about where the Dow is going to be if you're going to save money on the mortgage. So as far as what the 30-year rates are doing, they hit a low point in several months. And the Fed now is talking about, over the weekend, they said, well, we won't let things get out of hand. That we're going to look at some rate cuts. Now, those are back on the table, where for a couple of months they had pulled back on their optimistic, you know, three or four cuts this year. It was basically pulled back, and Wall Street was assuming they weren't going to cut at all. Well, now three cuts are back on the table, apparently, through conversations over the weekend. Not so much between now. The Fed meets in 9 days, and we can't expect anything to happen, so says Wall Street, until maybe the June, maybe the summer meeting. And then some of the Fed governors are forecasting potentially three cuts in a row. So I think all of this has come together. And last Friday, Tom, we had another weak job report. It was at least two in a row. For February, they were expecting 170,000 jobs, and it came in at 151. For January, it was only 125. And I know I've said this many times over our conversation that, you know, 300,000 a month is fantastic. That dribbled down all last year until it started with a two, and now it starts with a one. Those are weak reports, and the unemployment rate ticked up 1/10 as a result. So we have several of the tea leaves pointing to, well, maybe, you know, consumer confidence is down. Are people going to stop spending money? We saw that in a retail report just last month. So there's a lot of evidence that the economy may be slowing, and I think a lot of it's just due to uncertainty. And what do people start to do when that's happening? They kind of, you know, recoil, they pull themselves back, and maybe the trip to Pensacola that we were going to do in May, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should wait it out. And that would be that's the ingredients that you could have reduced economic activity. And many people call that a recession.
So where would the uncertainty be coming from?
Well, I think that if all of what they're doing on a national level, the people that are being laid off or taking early buyouts, that's not in the unemployment rate yet, and that's not in the numbers that we're digesting. So pretending that's not happening when we know it has. So you got low job reports. And consumer confidence is just the conversation of the tariffs is suggested that, oh, that's going to spur more inflation. Well, they would if they stuck around a while. And so that's where the uncertainty is. Well, OK, then maybe it'll be short lived. But what else could we say? Well, maybe they're not going to be short lived. Maybe it's going to stick around far longer than anybody wants them to stick around. Maybe more jobs will be lost. Maybe more businesses will close. And that's where consumer spending starts to drop, and that's the beginnings of a recession there.
And again, we're back to what's good is bad, what's bad is good.
Yes.
You don't want a recession, but you
Correct.
Don't want inflation either, so where's the sweet spot?
Tom, it's interesting. I wonder how many people would be genuinely interested in – I don't think a lot of people attach themselves to the budget deficit. And the $36 trillion, I mean, it's just a number. And everybody wakes up every day. It's like, well, okay, woke up again, and I made my coffee the same as always. Where is this going to start to hurt me? And I'm not seeing it. I'm not feeling it. Or they feel that way. And it's like, well, it's just a number. I don't have to care about it. Well, I think we all need to care about it, because by the time something would happen, by the time the bond market would really start backing up and say, you know what, we're not loaning the government any more money. I don't know if that's technically possible. Everybody's saying, well, how big is too big? And you have Japan at, you know, there's one of the worst in the world. You have their debt to GDP ratio is like 250%. And we just crossed 100 not long ago, and you got a lot of people say, oh, well, this is not going to be as harmful as a lot of people think. Well, you had a guest on, I think it was this morning, saying that the number one bill that the government, the largest single bill the government is paying right now is the interest on the debt.
That's right.
So how much further do we want that to go until it starts crowding out other spending? And I just think this is an unusual time in history where we have the administration saying, you know what, we're going to do something about it. We're going to reach going towards a balanced budget, but it's not going to be without a little bit of sacrifice. So I think all these things that they're doing collectively are to try to get us back in a better shape financially. And I hope they succeed, actually, but it might on the short run. Somebody's not going to be happy, or we're going to say, well, you know, we've got CPI and PPI coming out this week. So it's, you know, we're always bathed in these inflation numbers, but the Fed seems to think that this is going to come down. That's why they're talking about 3 rate cuts. So, you know, may all their guesses be right, and hopefully we're not going through, or businesses are not going through too much pain in the process.
All right, or those who can't afford it. Thank you, Mark. 7:54, yes. 6 till 8. We'll be back with Mark on Friday, when we help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. That's always the conundrum of cutting spending and bringing the debt under control. It will require sacrifice. Who can sacrifice? Who's willing to sacrifice? We'll see how it plays out politically. 7:54 now, traffic, WWO. Clouds are supposed to disappear, making it a nice day today. Plenty of sunshine, highs near 70. Nice week, really, up until Saturday, and then maybe some severe weather. They'll have to watch it and see. Joe Geruso joins us now, New Orleans City Council member. How you doing, Joe?
Good morning. I'm well. How about you?
I'm good, sir. How was Mardi Gras for you and the Gerusos?
Mardi Gras was fantastic. Everybody had a great time. Not a lot of happy teenagers going to school this morning with daylight savings.
Ooh, I forgot about that. Today's the first day back, huh?
Yes. So some gnashing of teeth this morning.
Into each life, a little rain must fall. So there you go. Let's talk about Mardi Gras, because I was talking to J.P. Morrell about this, and having been at New Orleans and Company, and again, thanks to them for their hospitality on St. Charles Avenue, I got to tell you, it's a lot nicer with all the ladders and all the tents and all of that kind of stuff. And I think maybe that could be a model for Mardi Gras to come, because everybody I talked to seemed to be liking it better. Thoughts?
Well, I think people do like it better, and unfortunately it seems like competition for space has become so much more severe than even 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so when you have more ladders, more tents, more everything, it just makes it harder for people. Obviously, I think the first focus this Mardi Gras, Tommy, was the safety along the route, and I know police enforced some of the new measures, but I'm not sure they did it maybe quite as strenuously as a result of what happened on January 1st. But overall, I think people seem to appreciate what was being done. And look, I generally think people are okay with enforcement as long as it's consistent and fair. And also, obviously, we don't want to encourage people to be camping out for 4 days on a route or spray painting lines or doing things, because it is a public space. It doesn't belong to any one person or family.
It would seem to me, again, and I had this conversation with JP, that the only reason these tents started showing up is because they became affordable. And it's not like this goes back to the 50s or 60s or anything. Nobody was pitching tents, but because they developed a tent that was light enough and affordable enough for people to bring out to the route, then suddenly that became a part of Mardi Gras. And it would seem to me, from a regulation standpoint, the easiest thing in the world would be no tents.
Yeah, I think our rule is, I have to go back and look at it. I think if it's a one-sided tent, it's okay, or something like a shade tent. So, yeah, I think that the tents are certainly a big issue. The ladders are another issue. Just having people crowd things out and put their stuff down. Obviously, it also goes as far as people putting sofas along parts of the route. Like, we just need to make sure that those things aren't there. And look, we have new rules. I think, by and large, the feedback was good on those rules. There's obviously small things that happen during the parades that you try and take a look at. And Tommy, look, I'll go one step further. I know it was lampooned in a couple of the parades, but we didn't have any power outages this year because of Mylar cannons or Mylar hitting the lines. And I would argue that as a result of changing the rules, because we didn't have Mylar cannons before, and now we don't have them again, and people didn't lose power. So I think when you have rules, sometimes they frustrate people, but at the same time, if they're done in the best interest and enforced well, then people can adapt.
And that's, I guess that's what I'm trying to say about the tents. That was a relatively easy thing, right? No Mylar confetti cannons, no Mylar balloons, whatever the rule was. So in this case, it would seem to me, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but just no tents. You can't have, I don't care if it's one side or two sides, no tents. You just can't have a tent. We went through God knows how many Mardi Gras without tents. Then all of a sudden somebody texted me, said old people and babies need tents. I don't know anything about that, but we went through years and years of Mardi Gras without tents. They seem to have more trouble. They make more trouble than they provide, and it just is for a way to people to take up space. I would just say no tents, but that's me. Let's talk about street repairs and where we stand with, how do we get this money from FEMA, Joe?
Well, the money from FEMA is still the money from Katrina. This is the money that's been allocated since the storm and everything that's been out there. I think the newest twist, but it's sort of what's old is new again, is when this administration came in, they were administering all of this work in-house. And that really created a whole bevy of problems, because you have so many projects, you have so much time to complete the projects, you have different project managers, and they really didn't create economies of scales. And it was sort of, in my view, Tommy, compounded by the fact that the administration had hired an outside consulting group called CSRS that essentially put together a framework for how this road work was supposed to be done. And its strongest recommendation is to hire an outside project management firm to oversee all of the work. Why do you want to have that? Because you create economies of scale, because you see what works, you see what doesn't work. It all flows essentially upward and into one way. And the way the city was doing it before this new project management organization, that it was sort of spread out into diffuse. And so you really weren't learning things, you weren't improving, projects were lagging behind because, again, the contracts were too long, there wasn't enough management over all of those. So they're going now towards the system. And of course, then the second question is, based on the money that we've had from Katrina, how much work is left to be done? And then of that work that's left to be done, what will be done and when will it be done?
I don't know if this is part of it or not, but just, you know, being a guy with a house and everything else, I know that generally speaking, contractors don't want to turn down any work, because if they do, somebody else is going to get it and they'll never get that job. So they would rather have 10 jobs going at one time than one and finish it, because even though it delays the whole thing for everybody, they get those 10 jobs that they maybe otherwise would not have had. Does that play into this at all?
Well, I think it's been a couple of different things. One is, do you have enough contractors? Two, until we pass the Net 30 ordinance, the city for generations, so I don't want to pin it on the Cantrell administration, was not great about paying their bills. And so what happens, you also then, Tommy, not only have contractors who want to take on as much work as they possibly can, but then you have contractors who are just saying, I can't be the float for the city. I'm not going to even bid on some of this work. So the goal is to get as many contractors as possible into the pool, and we're starting to see more come back and do some of the work. Obviously trying to see how much work somebody has. And I think you're right. Then some of the thing too is, hey, this is great that ABC Corporation Construction Company has 10 projects, but can they do 10 projects? Mm-hmm. And so I think the city is trying to weigh all of those things and trying to make sure that the work is done. And to me, not only done, but done well. And that means as little interruption to people as possible, hewing to deadlines as much as possible, trying to make sure that the work is accomplished the way it's intended to be.
Right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back, 8:22, talking to Joe DeRusso about the repair projects in the city and what happens from here, how many are left to be done. And, you know, you got a choice here. You can do them all at one time and tear up the entire city if you can find the contractors to do it, but I don't think that's accurate either. So what about extensions? We'll talk more, 8:22, Traffic, WWL. 8:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Joe DeRusso. Mayor Cantrell's in D.C. at some kind of foolish mayor's conference. I don't mean to mean a conference, but I got a text from somebody saying they're owed a lot of money, small contractor doing business with the city. When it comes to these road repairs, when it comes to the mayor's absentee status, how concerned are you, Joe, that she's completely just signed out, phoned it, whatever you want to call it, checked out and is looking to the next job or whatever, and how will that affect the operations of city government?
Well, I think what we're always concerned about is, and not that I have a countdown, but we're 308 days away from January 12th, and we get a new administration. How are we functioning, knowing that people are starting to look at what comes next, and just the natural psychological tendency of packing things in when you know there's going to be a new administration. And I think, Tommy, like, the tender balance we're trying to walk is we're the legislative branch. We can push things forward to a certain degree, but I can't make, nor can my colleagues, the administration, execute or do things that it's supposed to do. So I think it's about making sure that we are trying to be on the same page privately and publicly as much as humanly possible. And then if that doesn't happen, then using the bully pulpit to push for the things that people talk about. And look, to the person who just texted, obviously we know payment is an issue. And I will say, and will continue to say, if you took infrastructure complaints out of my email queue, I probably wouldn't have nearly the fraction of emails I have to answer on a daily basis. So we know it's one of the first and front issues in everybody's minds.
So when it comes to travel and the travel ban and who's paying for this, is she paying for this, or do you know?
We don't know. I guess I read the release last night, and it said something like the trip was on the calendar before the ordinance went to effect. I guess if it wasn't being paid with city funds, wouldn't the simplest thing to say that the city isn't paying for this trip? That just seems like the clearest way to deal with it. But since we don't know, I think the council is going to send a letter today asking what's happening and who's paying for it.
What about extension when it comes to FEMA money in these repairs?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is trying to get the notice to proceed done, and then also asking FEMA if there's more time available for repairs that don't happen. Usually those are granted as long as there's good considerations for why.
Scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you worried about the mayor having checked out and effect on city government?
I mean, I always worry that people need to keep their eyes on the ball. And as I say all the time, I will never be a guarantor for utilities. And when it comes to infrastructure in particular, I wring my hands about making sure things are being done in the way they ought to be.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your time as always. Joe DeRusso, New Orleans City Council member, 8:30. We come back, we're going to talk about the psychological and physical effects of the change to daylight saving time. What about the Exxon Valdez and the space shuttle crash? Could that have anything to do with sleep deprivation? We'll talk about it when we come back. Traffic, news, weather, all that stuff now on WWL. All right, so somebody texted in and said Dwight Eisenhower. No. Somebody else texted in and said, without doubt, that's FDR, and that's not right either. Al on a cell, line 3. Hi, you're on WWL. Who is that?
Hey, it's Lyndon Johnson.
It sure is. How you doing with daylight saving time? Do you have a hard time with this or not?
No, not after the first day.
Just one day, that's all it takes you?
That's right.
Hi, my friend. Thank you.
Right.
I hope you enjoyed playing.
Hey,
we got no prizes, but thanks for helping us. Ron Bailey joins us now, Professor Chair of Psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. How you doing, Doc?
Fine. Good morning.
Tell me about daylight saving time. You heard Al say it just takes him one day to get adjusted. Is that the norm, or how much of a problem is this for people?
Well, I appreciate the question, because I think it's been something that's been under-considered, underrepresented for some time. But we are seeing in psychiatry many more people than earlier thought who are having trouble making the adjustment. What my experience has historically been is you go to church on Sunday morning and the priest will make the comment, you guys are, you know, adjusting and are you late, as it were, just this weekend. But we're seeing people even throughout a week or so past that time struggling to get up in the morning and function. So it is a bigger problem than earlier thought.
How do you get over? Is it like jet lag? Is it analogous to that same thing?
I think it's a good example, because the reality is your body seems to be behind that timing. You think it's just a function of changing the clock from, you know, I think it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning or 7, 8, 8 a.m., but your body gets accustomed to doing certain things at certain times. When you eat your meals, when you get in your morning exercise, when you actually get in the car and deal with traffic, when you drive to work. And it takes longer than people would think. Very often, I could say up to 3 to 5 days for some people, not just one day, to adjust.
You know, as you say 2 o'clock, I suddenly realized that Teddy, the dog, woke me at 2 o'clock right on the button, and he had to go outside. And I don't know if he knew about daylight saving time or not. Does this have any effect on animals, or is that a dumb question?
No, I think it's a fair question. I think the reality is we all are creatures, to use that term, I think, of habit. Mm-hmm. I think we get accustomed to doing certain things at certain times. We don't realize how we, I think, indoctrinate our body and our brain to engage in those activities at those particular times. We think about it with sleep a lot, because it makes a great deal of sense. If we don't get to sleep at the regular time, whether you go to bed early like I do at, you know, 9 or 10, some folks, you know, my wife will stay awake till 11 or 12 midnight or whatever, having to change that by even an hour can throw off your body rhythm. When your rhythm is off, then when it's time to wake up, the rest of your body is not really ready to go just yet. You may be physically awake and your eyes open, but you're cognitively not thinking quite as clear. You're not really ready to move forward. We attribute it to how people say, I need my morning cup of coffee to be really ready to go. You're awake before you drink a cup of coffee, but your functionality, your cognition, your thinking, your sharpness, your alertness isn't really at that point just yet. And that at times, mistakes can be made if that's the case, such as driving. So we should take this a little bit more seriously than I think what we did before.
You go to bed at 9 o'clock and that's late. What is it, New Year's Eve? I go to bed at 7 o'clock. Doc, I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, so I got a different schedule. And along those lines, for people that work shift work, does this present more of a challenge to them? I live in Plaquemines. A lot of people work shift work. Thoughts on that?
That's the perfect example. I'm from Beaumont, Texas, originally. I mentioned that on your show before. And all my relatives worked shift work at a refinery as I was growing up. It clearly throws them off. I was actually in the hospital this weekend, and with the nursing staff that works the 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift, your body's accustomed to that typically. Again, being thrown off an hour is key. Mm-hmm. And some people think it's harder when you lose the hour of sleep more so than so-called gaining it, obviously.
You're reading ahead, because that was my next question.
Worse than the other one.
You're reading ahead. That was my next question. Does it matter one way or the other?
I think it's more difficult when you have to wake up the hour earlier. When, of course, you have more time to sleep, you can kind of push yourself a little faster in the afternoon and make yourself go to bed at a different time. But it's the waking up earlier and your body feels that it's short of sleep that gets you out of your rhythm and you're not really ready to go psychologically, cognitively. That's the one that I think really is more impairing for most people when they report to us in psychiatry.
Speaking of not being ready cognitively, when you say wake up early, that's what we're doing now because we set the clock ahead an hour? I'm confused now. Is that what we did today? We got up an hour early or late?
No, this was the one, because at 2 a.m. they made it 3 a.m., so I go to church at 9 a.m. My body really felt like it was 8 a.m., so you felt like you had to wake up earlier. Your clock rang an hour earlier than usual. You may think that it's just a numerical number, but your body tells you something. You're a little bit more sluggish. I think that you're not thinking quite as sharp or clear. If you're somebody who has a regular routine, you get up, you exercise, or you drink a cup of coffee or drink your paper or talk to a certain friend or relative or whatever, so much of that very often is squeezed. I think that's the piece that people are responding to. But this idea that it may last longer than just one day, the point I think you're making today, is timely. And I think we're seeing that even in past years. We're likely to see a lot more of that this week.
I'm going to go with that for the rest of the week, Doc. That'll explain any cognitive impairment I have. I'm going to go with sleep deprivation from daylight saving time.
Sounds good.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Dr. Ron Bailey, professor chair of psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Tariffs, supply chains, oh my, we'll talk about it all when we come back on WWL. I'm going to tell you what, every Friday we have a guy, JR, on from Taking Vegas, and he gives us a free on-air pick, and they're starting to look at me sideways at the sportbook where I do my business because I take his pick and I make a sizable wager, and I've been there like 4 weeks in a row with winning tickets, and the same lady is starting to look at me like, what's going on here? Stephen Melnick joins us now, our friend, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State, where he's done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurements, and supply chain design. We normally talk about EVs, and we will a little bit today, but we're going to talk about tariffs and supply chains and all that stuff. How you doing, professor?
Not bad. How about yourself?
I'm all right. You ever watch the show The Office?
Not really. Let's put it this way. Recently, I've been kind of busy. I've been involved in the CHIPS Act. I've been involved in a major project on that, and that's been taking up my time.
I got a lot of free time, and the only reason I mention that, there's an episode where one of the characters is talking about having a vasectomy and then having it reversed and then having it again and having it reversed, and he says, snip, snap, snip, snap, snip, snap. That's the feeling I get with these tariffs. I don't quite understand how you can practically put on a tariff, take it off, put it on, take it off, raise it. Take me through the process of tariffing before we talk about results, please.
Okay, basically a tariff is a tax. Let's be honest. What you're doing is saying that something that comes in from Canada or Mexico is going to be taxed, and somebody's going to have to pay for it. The concept is the one that often people think of is that the company who is bringing in the product pays it, but ultimately it's going to come back to the consumer. And in many cases, it's also going to impact how supply chains are developed. So imagine that a tariff is a tax. Anything you buy from Canada, anything you buy from the United States, guess what? We're going to take the price and add 25% to it.
But I guess the question I had is, what happens? Who institutes this tariff? Because the president says, all right, that's it. I'm putting a tariff on you. Okay, I'm taking it off. I'm putting it on again. I'm taking it off. Is somebody filling out a form? And I'm not trying to be stupid about this, Professor. And I want to open this up for the audience as well at 504-260-1870. Go ahead.
Well, what you've got is something that's occurring right now, which is the president's actions by putting them on and taking them off, they're creating a lot of uncertainty, a lot of confusion. And this confusion has resulted in companies not knowing what to do. If you're a company like Ford or GM or Stellantis or Toyota, any of the companies, you're going to find out that this is creating problems because you've got to think about how to respond. You've got to think about where to put your production. You've got to think about how this is going to impact prices. You also have to think about issues of how long. For example, if the tariff is just a minor spat, that is, Trump is upset with Canada and Mexico, and he puts it on for, let's say, a month, we're not going to be that bad. Most auto industry companies will have enough slack in the form of inventory in the pipeline. They can take care of it. But if it's going to be more than a month, then you've got an issue of how do you price cars? And that's going to be a major issue because right now people are complaining about the price of cars. And it's not only going to affect the price of new cars, it's going to affect the price of used cars. Not only that, it's going to distract us from preparing for China. And China's out there with its EVs. It's basically ready to come into our market. And on top of that, what people, even beyond the auto industry, the tariffs are going to impact other industries. And they're also impacting how other areas are responding. Doug Ford, who's the premier of Ontario, he simply said, guess what? I'm going to put a 25% tariff on all energy going to the United States. I'm going to take off all liquor that is produced in the red states. And the American government came back and said, well, we took off the tariffs. And his attitude was, no, let's get this resolved. So it's going to do that. And finally, it's also going to affect things like, are you ready for this? The defense industry.
So let me go back 1 second, and I don't want to waste a lot of time on this, but just for my own edification, Professor, if a tariff goes on, at what point do you decide what goods, and then comes off, what goods are tariffed and what aren't? Because well, wait a minute, okay. This crossed the line at this point and this didn't. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because stuff doesn't these are forces of law, right?
Yeah, not only that, but it's really complex. Let me give you an example. 2017, Bloomberg does a study. And what they were trying to do is understand the supply chain in the auto industry. And something as simple as one single electronic component in a circuit board, one of the most simplest items, it goes into a car seat. Mm-hmm. They found out that it crosses the border between Canada, the United States, and Mexico 4 times.
Really?
So
Then revised and then worked on again, or different pieces
added
to it? Okay.
And in some cases, you've got some major components across the border up to 8 times. So what you've got now is a really interesting question. When do we tariff it? Do we tariff it every time it comes into the United States? In which case, you've got this simple component, you've got an existing supply chain, and it's going to cross the border 4 times. So you basically tariffed it 4 times. So it's not simply 25% once, it's 25% once, comes back, gets shipped out, gets tariffed. And so now this is becoming complex. And so one of the major problems car companies are trying to figure out is, what's this going to do to the price of our product? And this is an issue at a time when most customers are complaining about the price of a car. Mm-hmm. As of January of this year, a new car average price is $48,118. Mm-hmm. A used car is $24,402. I've been looking at various estimates, and they're expecting if the tariff lasts over 2 months, they expect a 5 to 10% increase in price, which means car prices may go up as much as $12,000.
Okay, let me slow down a little bit here, because I'm trying to keep track of all of this. I never thought I'd say it, but I am going to say it, because it seems like something my father would have said. But you say the average price of a new car is $48,000. First house I bought was $53,000. So I guess that goes to show you how crazy it's getting. And then you're talking about financing for 8 years. But when it goes to building, let me get the audience in here too, Professor. We're going to have to go in a non-linear way if we can, because I want to get everybody's questions answered. How is it collected and by whom? Talking about a tariff.
Okay. Basically, it's every time comes in, the mechanics depend, but I think every time it comes in, the government's going to simply track the number of times it comes into the States, and it's going to say if it comes from Canada, you have to pay the price, you have to pay 25% of that price to us because you bought it from Canada. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be collected by the government.
Okay.
It could be collected at the border, or it could be collected, tracked at the border, because a lot of trucks coming across the border from Canada, Mexico, come in under CTPAT, which is basically an expedited system of crossing the border. And they're tracked. So every time they come in, we have a manifest. We take a look at the value, and the government sends you a bill and says, okay, you bought X number of thousands of dollars of parts. Here's your bill. Pay us.
So when it comes to passing that along to the consumer, and that's where I think people get confused.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Take me through that, Professor, if you can. Okay. And when it comes to pricing an object and price point, the cost of that going in, who's going to pay for the tariff? Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, in order to understand this, let's understand one thing. I'm going to take you back a step, because in order to understand how it affects pricing, somebody in your audience is going to say, well, can't we resource production from Mexico and Canada to the United States? No, it takes years to develop a supply chain relationship. I was talking with one company that's buying basically something simple, high-grade surgical stainless steel. Mm-hmm. And this is for a DOD application, Department of Defense, and they told me that if their supplier left, it would take them up to 2 years to identify, to evaluate, to integrate, and to educate the supplier and get them into the supply chain. It takes time. So what you've got going on is you've got a system which has evolved over 60 years. It's based on comparative advantage. For example, a lot of the assembly work is done in Mexico. Why? Wages are lower there. And so what's going to happen there is, as we look at it, we're going to start to see that it becomes difficult. And many of it becomes difficult in order to, you've got all these relationships, you've got more than transactions, you've got relationships. The suppliers get to know you. So you've got all of this present, and suddenly you're going to say, okay, you've got a month to change this. This is a system that's built over 60 years. You know, if you've worked with someone for a period of time, is there a value to that? Yeah. If you work with a company, do you have a doctor that you go to on a regular basis?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Why?
Because I know him and I trust him.
So he or she gets to know you, and over time, they get to identify things, and so there's a value of a relationship. So when we start thinking about reshoring things back to the States, number one, you've got to think about, do you have adequate capacity? Number two, do you have the capabilities? Number three, can you integrate them? And number four, can you build the relationship? And those are not trivial issues. So we've got an existing system built over 60 years. They're fairly complex. The average car, you can get up to 30,000 individual components going into a car. Some of them come from Mexico. Some of them come from Canada. So all of those things are coming together, and suddenly you've got to reshore that without disrupting existing supply.
Let me take a quick break, Professor. We're going to pick this up when we come back. 504-260-1870. If you have any questions about tariffs or about supply chains, Professor Stephen Melnick is our friend, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. And I learned this lesson a long time ago with a restaurant supply place and stainless steel mixing bowls, of all things. At that point, this had to be 10 years ago, you could get a stainless steel mixing bowl from China. And I just remember stainless steel, for whatever reason, for like $3. You could also buy one that was made in America for $24. I'm a consumer that is money cognizant, so I chose the one from China. And that goes to tariffs and manufacturing in the United States and company-subsidized labor in other government-subsidized labor in other countries. And can the U.S. really compete? And if so, at what cost? We'll pick it up with Professor Melnick. When we come back, 504-260-1870, we're talking tariffs on WWL. 927, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about tariffs with Stephen Melnick, a professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. And, Professor, what did you say you've been working on lately, as I asked you about watching the stupid TV
program? I've been working on a project with due to the CHIPS Act. What we're doing is trying to accelerate the establishment and development of microelectronic clusters within the United States. And last week at this time, I was in Rochester, New York, where we were reviewing the progress of our first round of awards. So I've been involved in that. And before we go any further, I just want to answer a question that you asked earlier. What's the process by which a tariff is collected? Mm-hmm. Well, the process is when someone crosses the border, CBP, which stands for U.S. Customs and Border Protection, mm-hmm. they will essentially have the importers, the trucks, whatever, classify and declare the value and quantity of the goods. CBP, which is Customs and Border Protection, will then review the paperwork, perform an audit where appropriate. Then they're going to collect the tariffs, penalties, and administrative fees, and then they will deposit those revenues into the U.S. General Fund. That's the process. So that means every time, if you look at this, you cross the border, potentially a tariff can be collected. That's why the issue I brought up to you before, if a product goes back and forth across the border, in the case of a simple little component into a assembly, which is used to control your seat, goes four times, does that mean that you tariff that item four times? In which case, it becomes an absolute nightmare for the auto industry.
Let me get to this, if I may. President Trump himself saying, and I think this goes to a difference between then and now. He said, we were at our richest from 1870 to 1913. That's when we were a tariff country. And then they went to an income tax concept. It's fine, it's okay, but it would have been very much better. And I think that goes to, at that time, tariffs were a source of revenue for the government, not necessarily a way to protect manufacturers, right? Take me through that in the history of tariffs in the country.
You're right. There was a transition. The last president to really embrace terrorists was McKinley. And McKinley was ultimately shot, but towards the end of his life, before he was shot, he started to see that tariffs were really a revenue source. And President Trump, with all due respect, I would argue that the richest the United States was from 1945 until about 1960. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, we were the manufacturing hub of the world. Europe was devastated. Japan was devastated. China was not a manufacturing country. The United States was basically the supplier to the world. This was the time when you saw a lot of things develop. Universities grew. You saw our incomes. You saw it was a time in which many people saw their standard of living. It was a time in which most people could afford a house. It was a time when the United States became viewed as basically the savior of the world when it introduced the Marshall Plan, which essentially prevented Europe from falling into the hands of the communists. So I would argue that's really the golden heyday. I think Trump is focusing on that period because it's consistent with the narrative as he sees it. But if you look at the United States after World War II and the United States in 1913, they were different. The industries were different, the respect was different, and the abilities were different. I don't think the United States of 1913 could have successfully fought the Second World War as it did.
Let me go to my stainless steel bowl example that I gave you before. This had to be 10, 15 years ago. I don't know if you heard me say it or not, but you know, I had stainless steel mixing bowls, right? And I'm a stainless steel kind of guy, Professor. I love stainless steel. My daddy did too. And I could get a bowl for $2.30 that was manufactured in China at that time, or I could spend $18-$20 for one made in the U.S. And I'll be honest, I bought the one made in China because, you know, I'm not independently wealthy. And that is in microcosm what we're talking about here, is it not?
Well, okay, you're getting into several things simultaneously. Okay. Let's kind of decouple things. The first thing that you're bringing up is the bowl that's coming into the United States that's at $3, mm-hmm. let's say, versus $18. Is it the same bowl? In some cases, you've got companies which will sell you something which looks the same but is of lower quality.
Okay.
The second issue that you're getting into is why is China able to produce that bowl at $3 and bring it in while Americans can't? And so that brings up the issue of what's going on. If it's a case of dumping, which is the Chinese are coming into the United States and they're selling products at less than their fixed variable cost, then guess what? You have an avenue. That's when tariffs are justified because they're punitive.
Hang on one second, Professor. What is the object for the objective for the country that is dumping? What is their end goal here?
It's very simple. They want to get market share. And one way of getting market share is to produce a product at a far lower price and then drive out the existing competition. Once you drive out the existing competition, then you can jack the prices back up.
And that's no different, really, than Walmart does with small mom-and-pop groceries, is it?
Well, yeah, but it is. There are some differences. Walmart has a reputation for being very cost-driven.
Okay.
But Walmart has also realized that they need to take care of their supply chain. They don't do as good a job as Costco, but they need to take care of their supply chain because if you drive a supplier out, you've got to replace that supplier. And that's a time-consuming process. It's an expensive process. And on the other hand, when you're dealing with suppliers, especially in the United States, you have to understand that it makes sense to have a supplier that you can depend on. And this is one reason why Walmart was one of the first companies to realize that many of their suppliers were small to medium-sized companies, 500 people or less. They had limited financial resources. And when they went out to borrow money so they could satisfy a Walmart contract, they wound up having to pay charge Walmart higher prices because they had to pay a higher interest rate. Walmart said, well, what if we worked with you and co-signed the loan? And that would drive down prices. And so Walmart was one of the first companies to tap into the power of what's known as supply chain finance. So be careful when you get into that, because in Walmart's case, you know, they are competing on low cost, but they don't want to be associated with anything that would seem to be negative, because many of their customers are employed by the very companies that they might be affecting. So
it may have been a bad comparison, but the end result, and I'm not trying to argue with the professor, you've forgotten more than I'll ever know about this, but when it comes to dumping or whatever, sometimes a large competitor can come in and maybe sell things at a loss to drive the small person out of the market. Then they go back to whatever they want to do. Accurate?
And that's a major issue, and that's, in fact, part of the major concerns that you see in industry, which is that there's an unfair competition, that large companies can use their resources, which is, in fact, if you want to be honest, one of the best examples of that is Amazon. Amazon basically copies other people's strategies and drives them out of the business. Mm. So there is that issue to be concerned about. But on the other hand, what you're also concerned about is disruptions. You've got this really great balancing act. You want to pay a lower price? Good. Are you going to get the same quality product? If not, you're going to pay more, in the sense that if you buy something cheaper from, let's say, China, and it comes in and it's not as good quality, that's going to be put into the car. The car is going to be taken out, and guess what's going to happen? It'll break down. Mm-hmm. Guess who's going to be charged with the warranty costs? You will be. Mm-hmm. You have a problem. So you're balancing the quality, the disruption, the price. You're also balancing the fact that you want to maintain a diverse supply chain. Why? Because you don't want it to be dependent on only a few suppliers. Because if those suppliers have a hiccup, you have a problem.
Professor, let me take a break right here. I could do this for 8 hours, and I hope you come back, because there are so many layers to this. And
of course,
man, I love when you correct me, because I'm trying to learn here. I'm trying to instruct help the audience learn about all this. When we come back, I want to talk about the United States being able to compete with other countries where the government actually subsidizes the manufacturing process, right? That happens. And I also want to look ahead to what happens with the auto industry 3 months from now, because I'm a little bit confused. We're going to have tariffs to bring back manufacturing, and the auto industry said, no, that's going to kill us. So the president said, all right, no tariffs for 3 months. What happens then? Because this is major industry. This is, I don't understand how you can have any. I wouldn't run a convenience store with this type of uncertainty. I don't know how you can run an auto industry like this as far as supply chain, tariffs, et cetera. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Stephen Melnick, 937, 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:45, quickly back to Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. Professor, we could almost do this once a week about tariffs, because it's very complicated. Yep. Somebody texted in, and I've already used the phrase tariff hold'em. It seems like that's what we're doing here. But who has the cards? Because somebody texted in and said there's no way either Canada or Mexico could stand up to the economy of the United States when it comes to tariffs. You would say what to that?
I would say that you're starting to see changes in both Canada and the United States in terms of relationships. Right now, Canada is exploring relationships with the EU because of the minerals. And Canada is doing some interesting things. Let me give you, you're right. You know, given the fact how intertwined the economy, you could say that's going to take place. But if you're starting to see a response which is beyond economic in Canada. And I should know that because I'm a dual citizen. I'm originally from Canada. I'm what we call a Canusian. And what you're starting to see is provinces like Ontario have taken a really hard stance, and they're saying this: you cannot jerk us around. We're gonna put tariffs not only on, things such as the energy, which Michigan, Ohio, New York, Maine, Massachusetts uses. We're also going to do things like ban liquor. So, for example, bourbon, which comes from Tennessee and Kentucky. Ontario's pulled them off its shelves. They're also looking at access to critical minerals. For example, you need things like iron ore, nickel, uranium. Canada is one of the major suppliers. And what's happening now is Canada's saying, okay, fine, if you want to play that game, we're going to explore opportunities with the EU, because the EU represents a viable alternative. But that takes time. But the issue that I think you're also bringing up, that the person at the other end got to realize, is Canada, the United States, and Mexico have developed a relationship. And because we've developed a relationship, we've developed the act of working together. Do you want to convert a relationship where there's goodwill and trust into one where it's strictly transactional, where we look at everything and say, guess what, it's based on how much you bring to the table? I would argue that that view is short-sighted. And why is it short-sighted? Because in the auto industry, let's establish something. How much do you think the auto industry contributes to the United States economy? Mm. Pick a guess.
I don't even know how to start, Professor. Percentage or dollars? Tell me.
Okay, it's $1.2 trillion a year.
Wow.
Or 5% of our, and that's directly. It doesn't pick up indirect effects. The businesses, this maintenance, the people who service. Right now, if you're an American, if you're in the United States, my biggest concern, if I'm in the auto industry, is China. Now, why China? Because you were picking it up before the break.
Mm-hmm.
China has benefited from a directed economy. The Chinese government has understood the lessons of the past, which is the best time to disrupt a dominant competitor is when the technology changes. I'll give you an example. How many, do you remember years ago there was a product called WordPerfect and word processing?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Everyone had to use WordPerfect. Now, that was because this was when you had a screen and you had to put in the codes and you could go back and forth between the screen and what the document would look like formatted. A company called Microsoft, small little company, is looking at this, and WordPerfect is dominant. It has the major percentage. So Windows comes up. What does Windows do? It gives a graphic interface. What you see is what you get. And so instead of tacking WordPerfect and saying, we're going to give you something in the existing, it waited until the graphics interface took place and said, we'll give you a word processor that works in that environment. WordPerfect had a problem. How do I respond with by keeping my existing, without losing my existing users and attracting a new? It had difficulty. Now what's happened? Microsoft Word is the major word processor. The Chinese are looking at the industry and saying, where are we going? We're going to EVs. So they've encouraged massive investment in EVs in China. And if you want to see what it's going to be like if we don't have a joint unified strategy to deal with China, just look at Australia. Their auto industry is dominated by Chinese cars. And why? Because the Chinese have an interesting strategy of what they do is they come in from the bottom. And you can see that right now in the cars that they're showing in Los Angeles to many of the car influencers. These are cars under $30,000, $50,000, phenomenally technologically advanced, high quality, with better feature than many of the EVs we have in the United States. So if I'm in the auto industry, I need to work with Canada, Mexico, and with the manufacturers in the United States so we can put together a unified strategy so we can meet the Chinese and offer the consumer a fairly priced car that they can use. The tariffs are causing Americans, Canadians, and Mexicans to become adversaries. And that's the worst thing to do.
So here's what I'm thinking from what you're saying. We only have a couple of minutes left, Professor, and you have to come
sure.
back. But what my concern is that somehow we encourage Mexico, Canada, and the EU to start doing more business with China, and somehow the United States winds up the odd fellow out. Is that
that's a real possibility. And let me give you just an example of where that's really becoming an issue. Again, when you talk with me, you know a straight line is a curve.
Mm-hmm.
Right now in the NATO, the dominant standard for military warfare is American. Mm-hmm. And if one of our major exporters in terms of the surplus, in terms of the balance of trade balances, is the defense industry. We're now starting to see Poland, Norway, Finland, Canada, considering dropping the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. Why? Because they're concerned about two things. Number one, the United States is not committed to NATO. And number two, they're concerned about the fact that in this trade war environment, what's to prevent the Americans from saying, well, the F-35 strike fighter has American technology on information. We won't allow you to use that. That's what makes the F-35 so powerful. So now what you're starting to see is this whole series of actions has disrupted what previously was a fair, you know, there were stresses. Let's not put it down. I mean, how many, you know, the percentage of GDP that countries were using to support military. But the whole issue is China is a major force. We've got to do something as a country, and we need our partners to do that.
And real quick, before we let you go, I can't believe that countries with a proximity to the United States like Mexico and Canada, that we really want them to have a stronger relationship with the Chinese, do we?
No, we don't. In fact, we want to keep the Chinese out. And we don't want to keep the Chinese out by means of higher prices and tariffs. We want to keep the Chinese out by offering a superior product at a competitive price. That should be our goal. The consumer, not the stockholder, should benefit from our efforts.
Professor, thank you. Never enough time. We'll talk to you again soon because it is complicated stuff. Were that it were so simple to say, that's it, tariff done. We don't do business with you, but it's not the way it was back in the 1890s or 1913s. Thank you, sir. Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management, Michigan State, done research in the strategic supply chain, cybersecurity, performance measurement, supply chain design. I hope you can appreciate that for the apolitical discussion it was. I'm just trying to look at causes and effects here and processes as opposed to results. We'll take a break, find out what Noel Norman's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.